Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. Welcome to the Metron Live podcast, coming to you live from beautiful historic Midtown Atlanta in the month of December, the year of our Lord 2019. It's about to be the year 2020. Metron people, give the podcast people a big welcome. Thank you for listening. My series this month, I posted this on Facebook this morning. I said I'm starting a new series, but I'm also revisiting some previous themes with added revelation. And interestingly, I looked in my Facebook memories from 6 years ago, as I was talking about some of these things then, but I have new light on them. Particularly, well, let me give you the title first, then I'll explain it. It's a Wonderful Life, Freeing Yourself from the Ghost of Christmas Past to Follow Your Star in the Future. Of course, there's three, it's alluding to three things there. The Frank Capra classic, It's a Wonderful Life. The Ghost of Christmas Past, of course, is a reference or a nod toward A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens. And then, of course, The Star in the East is the nativity story. Some people say Jesus is the reason for the season. No, he's not the only reason for the season. Christmas was celebrated on December 25th. It was called something else, but it was there's a winter solstice that was celebrated by the pagans and other religions for millennia before Jesus was born in Bethlehem. The birth of Jesus actually happened around April, but the Catholic Church Christianized all the pagan holidays, so the vernal equinox and the winter solstice, all those things became either Easter or Christmas or whatever. So Jesus is one of the reasons for the season. And I think all of the characters, of course, our favorite one, of course, is the birth of the Christ child. But there's some amazing characters that we revisit every Christmas, like the Grinch, like Ebenezer Scrooge, like Charlie Brown. Many of the characters that are in the Christmas carols. And I've talked about this for years, but I think it's important that we recognize that Christmas is a time, whether you consider yourself Christian or not, Christmas is a time where people believe for the impossible. The fact that we, as from a Christian paradigm, celebrate it with an angel saying to a virgin, you're going to conceive because the Holy Spirit's going to plant the seed in you. It will not be a human seed. Even though now we realize if sperm isn't actually seed, it's now we know biologically it's actually fertilizer for seed, but who knew? In ancient times, they didn't understand about chromosomes and that sort of thing, but that's another teaching. I'm going to spend these installments this Sunday and the next two Sundays. The last Sunday, the last Sunday of the month, I'd like to, Ed, if you're here, I'd love for you to do Beautiful Star of Bethlehem. It's like, to me, that's a Christmas tradition. I can't have Christmas without that. And I'd even like to open it up if there's other people that want to do some Christmas music. That would be a great time to do that. So let me know if you're interested. If you can sing. Now, if you can't sing, don't be expecting a Christmas miracle. Now, I can't carry a tune, but I just believe when I get up and open my mouth that day, the Lord's going to bless me. No, he's not. We're going to let us save you the embarrassment. If you've lived your whole life and you can't carry a tune, we love you, but you still can't carry a tune. So let's just embrace our limitations and stay in our lane. Yes. So, but I do. You know, we've been listening. Ken could listen to Christmas music 365 days a year, and he started. Yeah. Speaking of someone who can actually sing. I don't want to say that there were people who pulled up in the parking lot last week who didn't know. I'm not mentioning anybody in this room. But in fairness to her, she has been on tour and so it's easy to miss an announcement or two. But I'm glad you made it today. She can't say a lot about it, but I know some things have been posted about already. There's some really cool things on the horizon for Chandra and through Tyler Perry, and so. And so, I mean, it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and she and I have had several conversations because it's kind of been a journey for her about learning, you know, what to expect and what to release and when to be, you know, not to. Read too much into something, you know. It's been. We've had some really good conversations about things that, you know, we're all learning about. What does it mean to make it or get a connection or finding a breakthrough, and realizing that you've already made it and there's not a thing that you're waiting for to happen or whatever. So, 2020 is going to be a big year for her, and we're all excited. But back to what I'm talking about. We've been listening to Christmas music for a couple of weeks now. I mean, today's just December 1st, and I've already heard the repertoire over. I've heard enough that now I'm like, good Lord, how many people covered that song? You know, and there's some of the covers. I'm like, no, you should have left. It wasn't broke. Don't try to fix it. It was fine with the original. And I'm pretty much of a purist. You know, I want to hear Bing Crosby sing White Christmas and Nat King Cole sing the Christmas song. There's certain, like, that's my version of choice. But then once in a while, somebody will come up with a new cover, and I'm like, okay, that was good. And the good thing about when someone interprets a song, this is certainly true. I've told Marshall Ruffin this. Marshall definitely interprets a song. That when he'll do a cover of somebody else's song, it makes you think about it in a way that you haven't thought about it before. Like, oh, wow, that made me rediscover that song. Dolly Parton wrote I Will Always Love You to Porter Wagoner back in the late 60s. And it had a country music following for years. Well, then when Whitney Houston covered it for The Bodyguard, it kind of rewrote the song. And most people now, when they think about I Will Always Love You, they're thinking about Whitney's version. And believe me, Dolly loves Whitney's version. Dolly made lots of money from Whitney's version. So Dolly ain't mad at Whitney. I mean, MC Hammer used, Give It To Me, Baby, who did it? Rick James, he used Can't Touch This, was actually the, she's a very freaky girl, Super Freak, of course you knew that. Yeah. My playlist, I'm listening to like Barbara Streisand and stuff. Ken will play Top 40 Radio. He knows every new song. I'm like, how do you know these songs? He knows the rap part. Everything. Like, what? Who are you? But yeah, like Rick James, who's now gone on, but he made $50 million from MC Hammer using his beat. So anyway, sometimes a cover of a song will make you rediscover it. There's three that I want to talk about, and I've talked about them before, but I there's some things I've never shared along these lines. Today I want to talk about The Little Drummer Boy. Next week I want to talk about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and then I want to talk about Ebenezer Scrooge. But today I want to revisit this song, because the more I have listened to it, and I've heard several people's version of it just this week, but every time I listen to it, I hear something else. I don't even know if the writer intended for all of this stuff in the song, but these are the things that I hear. It's interesting because I've been listening to this podcast about Dolly Parton as a writer, and there's this union movement that uses the song 9 to 5 as their anthem. And the woman was breaking it down, the lyrics-wise. She says, let me show you how the progression of the song about community, about what. It was just very interesting how you can hear something in a song. To me, you know, the scripture says the spiritual man judges all things. So every movie I watch there's something that it says to me. There's a theme that I think. I can't watch The Wizard of Oz without getting 10 more sermons out of it, because it's such a multi-layered parable about not realizing who you already are, and there's the trials of life that make you realize you already do have the brain, you do have the heart, you do have the courage. You don't think you have it, but there's so much you could say about it. But let me give you a little background about the song "The Little Drummer Boy." And this is what it says in Wikipedia. It says, "The Little Drummer Boy, originally known as the Carol of the Drum, is a popular Christmas song written by the American classical music composer and teacher Catherine Kennicott Davis in 1941. First recorded in 1951 by the Trapp Family Singers." Now that's Sound of Music was based on the Trapp Family. So they're the ones that popularized it. The song was further popularized by 1958 recording by the Harry Simeon Chorale, which that's the one that most people hear. That's personally my favorite. It's where this little kid's voice is singing, and it's very, it's just very methodical. The whole point is that there's a drum beat that brings a continuity to the entire piece. The parumpa pum pum becomes there's nearly a hypnotic sensibility to it, where you hear, you know, rum, bum, 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 bum. So and there's not a big range either. So the melody keeps you where you have to really focus on not the vocal arcs and that sort of thing, but just on the steady. It's a march, really, is what it is. Sort of a subtle marching. Listen to this song. There's something that you need to hear in this. This Simeon version was re-released successfully for several years, and the song has been recorded many times since. In the lyrics, the singer relates how, as a poor young boy, he was summoned by the Magi to the nativity of Jesus. Without a gift for the infant, the little drummer boy played his drum with approval from Jesus' mother, Mary, recalling, "I played my best for him, and he smiled at me." Now, I've talked about Little Drummer Boy before, but I want you to try to hear this with new ears, because I want to talk about some aspects of it that I didn't cover before. The first thing that really stands out to me in this song is the word "they," when it says, "Come, they told me." Now, who is they? The Magi, of course, are these Persia, of course, is ancient Persia was where Iraq is now. They were diviners, they were kings, they practiced magical arts. That's where we get the word magi, magic, from. They were not just astronomers, they were astrologers. They didn't know anything about the messianic prophecies about a Messiah. They had never heard of that. These men are Persian. This was even centuries before the Quran was written. So these men, they have no holy writ. They know, their theology totally comes from the Zodiac. The religion Zoroastrianism came from this part of the world too. That's where you get the yin and the yang. You see the black and white thing. That was their mentality. If you remember in Matthew's, the only of the gospel writers, well, actually there were 300 gospels that were written, but the Council of Nicaea only allowed for four. That's why people say the Bible is the Word of God. I'm like, you need to go look that up again, because you just clearly don't know about the history of the Bible. There's a lot that's been written. But I do believe the Bible that we have is inspired, and I love it. But in Matthew's Gospel, it's the only time the Magi is mentioned, and it's where they say, "Where is he who was born the King of the Jews?" They go to Herod's palace. "For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." So clearly in ancient lore, there was an idea that a super king was going to be born at a certain time. And these men charted the Zodiac. Now, I don't know how long it would have taken them to travel on the back of an animal from Iraq to Palestine. But I would imagine it's the kind of thing that you have to plan for way in advance. And when they get to Herod's palace, remember, Herod didn't know what they were talking about. They said, where is he's the king of the Jews? And he's like, hello, I'm the king of the Jews. What are you talking about? And he's threatened by this idea because, well, clearly these men are potentates from another nation, and they must know something that's so important that they've, well, the song says, bearing gifts we've traversed afar, field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star. And so he calls for an expert in ancient texts. And that's when, remember, he says that a man who knew the scriptures, he found the prophecy from Micah, who said that the virgin would conceive and give birth in Bethlehem. So on that word, the Magi leave Jerusalem and they go to Bethlehem. Now Israel, for that, it would be like going from North Georgia to South Georgia. I mean, Israel's not that big. But you know the rest of the story. And there's some, you know, some scholars even believe that the Old Testament Joseph and the New Testament Joseph were the same story, and they got conflated because there's such similarities in them. They both have to do with Egypt. Babies were killed, you know, in the Moses story, all the babies were killed, and the Jesus story, all the... So my intention here is not to get off in the weeds about that. For our purposes today, let's stay with the biblical narrative as we know it from the Judeo-Christian text. But suffice it to say, these guys were a big deal, the Magi. They were important enough, they get an audience with Herod. So these aren't just some indigent people who showed up. These are people who, I don't know how it would have worked in the ancient world, but did they send letters? How did they get an audience with the king? Now, what's that got to do with the little drummer boy? Well, she's not here today, but I was talking to Dr. Sheila a few weeks ago, and she said, explain to me how this could happen. She said, I just talked to somebody that sat under your ministry for years and still is connected in some ways, who said to me, I don't disagree with anything Bishop teaches. I've just never thought it applies to me. I've always thought it applied to the important people. And she said, how could somebody sit under your teaching for that long? Because that's what you're known for, is making everybody feel like they're invited to the table. And I said, well, this is why you have to get into, you can't just throw theology at people. You've got to understand what's the labyrinth that the word has to go through to get to them. Because if you don't assume you're being seen, if you don't assume that you're being looked at, if you don't assume that you're important, then people can talk about things, but you think, well, this doesn't apply to me. This is to the people that count. So this story is as much about class consciousness, class warfare, and especially, I know we still have to deal with things today, but in the ancient world, they believed that if you were born to nobility, you were born to nobility. If you weren't, you're just too bad, so sad. You know, the idea of liberty and justice for all is a relatively new idea. It's the reason why people from Europe who came here and founded this concept that we now have called America, it's why it took them a while to have a moral conflict about slavery, because they just didn't think of people that were not from Europe in the same category. They just didn't. You know, white privilege isn't a new thing. I mean, it's a lot of what we have now in America was based on that concept. So when they said all men are created equal, what they meant was all men from Europe. And they specifically meant men. I mean, women were less in their consciousness than people of color were. It was like, you know, at least with African Americans, they, you know, they got the vote before women did. You know, women. But so the premise of this song is set up that this is this. I mean, it's a fictional character, but he's just all he's got is this little drum. And so the picture is the song that these men are. These are the Magi. I'm visualizing they probably got an entourage they travel with. I mean, you know, usually in the nativity scene you see three men on a camel, but I'm sure for this kind of journey there had to have been an entourage, and you know, so you're probably talking, you know, who knows how many people were in that company of people. So for him to say, come, they told me, and it says, a newborn king to see, pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, our finest gifts we bring. Let me show you the lyrics, and then I'll talk about it. It's, there's number two. Yeah. Come, they told me, pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, a newborn king to see, pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, our finest gifts we bring to lay before the king. Go on. So to honor him when we come. Now, hold it right there. Now, that sounds like a very benign statement. Come with us. We're rich. We're connected. We're powerful. We're famous. We had an audience with the king. And we have our finest gifts to bring. And, you know, a lot of times in modern context, we understand gold, frankincense, and myrrh. The gift of gold was like setting up a trust fund for Jesus. It's like, you know, these were major monetary gifts. So to say to this little, let's imagine this kid is real, this little indigent little drummer boy, all he's got is his drum, to say, come with us because we're taking our finest gifts, that can sound kind of exclusive. That can sound like, well, there's no room for me in that scenario. You know, when you really look back at the Gospels, I've told you this for years, whatever your political persuasion, you can enforce it through the Gospels. There's a conservative ideology, you can espouse capitalism, you can espouse socialism, communism. I mean, there's whatever your ideology of choice, you can find, even in the Gospels, something to support your ideology. I always say this when I talk about this, but at Coretta Scott King's funeral, I was listening to, there were Republican and Democrat senators and ex-presidents that all spoke, and they all used the scripture, and they were all propping up their platform with the scriptures. And I thought, wow, the scriptures are really elastic. Do you know what I mean? They're not. They're very fluid, because everybody's using it to buttress their viewpoint. But in the Gospels, and you know, I in the past I was accused of being a prosperity preacher. I certainly never considered myself that. But from the Gospels, it's a little bit of a hard sell to really preach a prosperity gospel. Now you can, from Proverbs, and even from some of Paul's epistles, you got a lot of stuff for prosperity. But when you really look back at the Gospels, Jesus was really talking to disenfranchised poor people most of the time. Poor people who thought rich people had something that was unavailable to them. Remember when Jesus said, remember when he says to the rich young ruler, sell everything you have and give it, and the rich ruler couldn't do it? And Jesus said, he didn't say it was impossible, but he said, it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of the needle. And he wasn't talking about a sewing needle. It was smaller gate in the city where a camel could get through it, but he'd have to get on his knees to go through it. It was very difficult. It was difficult enough that most people with camels wouldn't even attempt it. But it could be done in theory. But what's interesting about when Jesus said it's easier for the camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to be saved, the disciples were shocked that he said that. Because they said, well, then who could be saved? So clearly, in their consciousness, they thought the rich people were the good people. The rich people were connected. The rich people obviously did something right. Because obviously, they got everything. They're going to be saved too, right? Like they couldn't believe Jesus said something negative about affluent people. Two stories that stand out in the Gospels that make me think of this. One of them is the story of the woman with the issue of blood. Because if you read it in context, if you remember the story is that Jairus, the leader of the temple, comes to him and says, my daughter is sick, and will you come and heal? And so Jesus said, yeah, I'll come and heal her. And it's en route to Jairus' house that the woman with the issue of blood touches the hem of his garment, And Jesus says, "Who touched me?" And what when I used to tell this story, I made it a point to always say, here's this, it's a big deal that this guy Jairus is coming to Jesus, because this could be a good career move for him. This guy's very connected with religion. And now you got this little, she is ruining everything. This woman that we don't even know a name for her. We know the name Jairus, but she's just the woman with the issue of blood who's got a nasty disease that Leviticus talked badly about. And here she's had it for 12 years. Like, she's just go away. Even the fact that this says she had to go through the press to get to Jesus meant that there were people who didn't want her there in this scene. I remember, I don't know if you've ever watched some of the things at the King Center or whatever, but he's an Atlanta icon. He's a man, they call him the happy preacher, and he's at all these events, and he decks out, and he's got a little tambourine, and he draws a lot of attention to himself. He makes funny comments, and you know, if you're trying to lead a serious thing, he can be distracting. I love him because I've sat through some of these 5 and 6 hour events that he actually made them much easier because he's just so entertaining. But I also remember going into Mrs. King's funeral, he was in front of Judah and me, and they turned him away. They wouldn't let him in. I could tell they didn't want him, and I mean the higher ups of the church would not let him in. And it was really kind of awkward for me because I thought, well, I feel bad you're not letting him in. And they knew him really well and they didn't want him. This was a very austere occasion. They just didn't want him in there. And I thought, wow, I hope a lot of people didn't see that, because this is really, I mean, if it was such a big deal, I would probably say, if you don't let him in, don't let me in. But you know, it just caught me off guard, and next thing I knew, I was like, well, okay, that was awkward. But I understood what it is that when you've got an event going on, and there's one person's there, going to mess it up. Am I being too real? So, I think about this, because when Jesus healed the woman with the issue of blood, he called her daughter publicly, which in that context was him saying, you're just as important as Jairus is. I'm going to take the time to minister to you. As a matter of fact, the story ends up being more about her, really. And at the end of it, they come to, after the whole thing happens with her, they come to Jesus and say, don't bother the master anymore. Your little girl is dead. And Jesus says, just be not afraid, only believe. And then he goes and raises her from the dead. But the point is, that story is about a rich, connected, powerful man. And within that story is a story of a woman who is invisible, who, I mean, I always say this to you, but even in the Gospels, hardly any of the women have names ascribed to them. We know all the names of the apostles, but it's the woman with the issue of blood. It's the woman at the well. It's the woman who was Jesus. I mean, women aren't even personalized, other than like Mary Magdalene and a couple of the main players. Women are just, they're just not thought of as equals with men. They're just not. And so when Jesus would say to a woman publicly, call her daughter, that was a real stamp of approval on her. And another one that I think of is that, there was two Lazaruses in the, it's plural, Lazari, two Lazaruses in that. One is the Lazarus that Jesus raised from the dead. The other one is the story in the Gospel of Luke, which the people who are proponents of a literal hell, they use this story a lot. It's the story of Lazarus and the rich man. And it's, the way houses were in this part of the world, they were nearly like, they were more like estates. Like you would have a house that would be walled in, and there'd be other houses in the, it's kind of like a plantation was like. It's like there'd be a wall around it, and there were servants' quarters, there were all these. So when you talked about, closing the door for the night, you weren't talking about like a house or an apartment. You're talking about a gate that surrounded a complex. Okay? And there's a story, I think it's Luke 16, where there's a man named Lazarus, and it's, I want to tell you all that it says about him. It's, he's in bad shape. He's sick. He's poor. He's a beggar. He's on this rich man's front step, and the rich man won't acknowledge him. He won't feed him. He won't do anything. He won't help him out. I think about this a lot because, you know, where I live, there's homeless people that live under the overpass by my building, and I can see, you know, I mean, I live in downtown. I mean, I see tents set up everywhere, and, you know, I've done what I can over the years. I mean, I was doing homeless ministry before Safe House even started. Union Mission used to be across the street from where Safe House is now on Ella Street. I used to go there and minister. I mean, I've ministered to the homeless for years and years and years, even when I didn't live downtown. And still, you know, when you live here a lot, you kind of learn, you know, who to give to and who not to give to. One guy one night came up to me with a story, wanted me to buy him dinner. I said, I already bought you dinner. He said, no, you didn't. I said, yeah, I did. You gave me the same story about 2 weeks ago on Peachtree. And he said, I did. I said, yeah, you got to get a new story. Because I said, I'll feed you again, but I'm having deja vu. So, and you know, you get a little street smart when you live down here. Like, Joan, I don't know if you remember, you and Ken and I, for some reason, the three of us were going to see a movie. We were at Atlantic Station. Remember that girl comes up and she's telling us this story. She's crying about how she's being abused and she's kicked out of her house. And we're like upset and I'm giving her $20 bills, everything. You know, we go sit down in Starbucks and 2 minutes later, she's walking by on a cell phone, smoking a cigarette, laughing and talking. I thought, this girl is better than Meryl Streep. Because she had us all. We're like, she had the story. And so it's easy for me to walk by certain people like, I can't do it today, bud. Okay. And then sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. There's a lot of issues that go on, you know, like the guy around the corner from here that I think he was the 23rd person that had approached me that day. And he started coming. I said, buddy, I don't have any money on me today. And he said, I can't believe how racist you are. That is racial profiling. What made you think I was going to ask for money? I said, all right, fair enough. I shouldn't have judged you. What do you want? He said, well, I do want money. I was like, well, I was trying to save us both some time because I was pretty sure that's what you were going for. But I'll try to be more sensitive next time. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, especially when you wear a collar downtown, it's like you're a homeless magnet. You know, it's like, I'll take this thing off right now. And then there was the other story about the guy. He had asked for money, and I said, I don't have any money on me. And then as I walked out, I thought, you know what? That's a lie. I do. I didn't realize I had forgotten. I do. I have got a $20 bill. I thought, I'm going to go give him this $20. So I turned around, and just as I got to him, he said, all white people are sorry. And I said, you know what? That's going to cost you $20. You were real close to 20, but I'm going to put my sorry 20 bucks back in my sorry pocket. But the story of Lazarus, it's an interesting story. This is the one where they both die, and Lazarus goes to what they call the bosom of Abraham, which was it's a fable. But the rich man goes into Hades, and it's the one time where Jesus does talk about fire. Remember where he says, would you just tell Lazarus to come dip his finger in the water and quench my tongue and go warn my brothers, whatever. And what's interesting about the story, when people want to really use it to prove literal hell, they miss the point of the story because the story is basically a communist manifesto. Because what he says, well, in that life you had everything and he didn't have anything. So now the tables have been turned and now he has everything and you have nothing. So if you follow the theology of that, it would be that all rich people go to hell and all poor people go to heaven, which I don't think that's what Jesus was saying. People miss the point. All he was saying is, for God's sake, how hard would it be to walk out and give the guy something on your, you know, who's on your doorstep, give him something to eat, which is why I mentioned that about the homeless people around my building, because sometimes it can be overwhelming. On cold nights, when I drive by and I see them sleeping on the sidewalk, I'm like, good God, how are they going to make it through the night? But I can't go fix all of that. However, if somebody was on my front step, Yes, of course. I mean, you got to be some serious heartless when somebody's at your front door. One of the funniest things your oldest brother ever said to me is when he lived one of those places he lived. He didn't have a car and he was walking. I mean, he was walking through a very dangerous part of town. And if I ever even stopped to get gas around there, people come up to the car while I'm pumping gas, ask for money. So I asked him, I said, Jared, do people not, panhandlers not bother you, you know, walking through this neighborhood? And he said, everybody here knows I don't have anything. They're not going to. I said, oh, well, that's the upside to your lifestyle. I guess when you look at me, it looks like I got something that you may want. One time I was pumping gas over here in little Five Points, and a guy comes up, and I think I gave him a dollar, and the proprietor comes out with a tire iron and says, I told you to leave my customers alone, and starts chasing him around my car. I'm like, no, it's fine. Don't hit him. It's fine. I wanted to give him the money. Please. I said, dude, you better get out of here. They're going to crack your skull open. Anyway, but the story of the rich man and Lazarus was basically him saying, he's talking about class distinction. He's basically saying everybody is worthy. Everybody, there shouldn't be the good guys and the bad guys. And, you know, it's not just Christianity, but even like Hindu societies were based on a caste system. And, you know, so it's prevalent through a lot of religions about these are the good people and here's the lowlifes. And there are some people that still, they don't even realize they think that way, and they still think that way. So when he says, come, they told me our finest gifts to bring, the fact that he still goes to the manger scene means, wow, this kid doesn't realize this is beyond, he's out of his league here. You got nothing to bring. Like, I remember, this isn't who maybe you think I'm talking about, but I went through a little period in my life where I was friends with a lot of pro ball players. And these, you know, these are people that have $25 million a year contracts. And this one couple that I kind of knew, they got pregnant, and we got an invitation to the baby shower. And they had a list of the places where they were registered. And there was, I mean, everything was Tiffany's. There's nothing you could have bought at any of these stores that would be less than $1,000. And I'm looking at this thinking, wow, first of all, you got a lot of nerve inviting people to this baby shower, saying these are the stores we have to, I mean, this is, like, I just looked at it, I thought, I'm not rich enough to be friends with you. Like, if this is where you're registered, I mean, there's a part of me that wants to say, why are y'all even having a baby shower at all? I mean, couldn't you, you know, you're making $50 million a year. Why can't you just sit down and say, here's everything we need. We just bought it. Thanks. So when I hear this, our finest gifts we bring come with us, there's a lot of potential to be intimidated by that. If you don't have the right gift, oh, I'm out of my league. You guys are amazing. You're rich enough to travel. You're important enough to have an audience with a king. You're enlightened enough to be able to read the zodiac and know when this child's going to be born. I mean, like, you're too rich for me. You're too smart for me. You're too connected for me. I don't even know I'm having a conversation with you. You know what I've learned over the years of this? I've had this conversation enough times that I finally realized it was the truth. People in the past that I would be intimidated by, if we ever had a chance to talk and get really honest, they would always say the same thing back to me. They'd be like, I'm just so intimidated when I'm in your presence. And I'm like, blah, blah, blah. What? No, that's my line for you. How can you be intimidated for me? It's... You know, sometimes you don't realize how people are perceiving you. Like, I even remember one time a few years ago, Robert Robert's in the screen. Robert knows a lot of people that I don't know, and he'll get invited to these little conferences, whatever. And one day I asked him, I said, how come that, I said, none of those guys ever invite me to these things. Like, how do you get the invitation? He said, they would never consider inviting somebody like you to their little conference. I said, why? They said, because they think of you as, you know, you're too big and important to come to my little conference. I said, why? Why would they think, like, I don't think of myself that way. I've never thought, oh, I'm too good to go to that. I've just never thought that. But clearly there are people that think you think that. Perception's an amazing thing. I remember even one time years ago, we're long past this, but I remember when the church was really big and I was on TV and, you know, just very connected and a lot, just kind of living a very sort of different life than I live now. And I was having Howie, my friend that I talk about so much, this was years ago, we were talking about something. I was asking his opinion, and he actually said to me, he said, I can't believe you even care what I think anymore. I said, what? What are you talking about? And he said, well, where you are in life, why would my opinion even matter? I said, that is the most ridiculous thing you have ever said. Like, you're like my best friend. You're like one of the most important people to me. He said, I know, but the way people see you, like, I remember even when I left the Assemblies of God years ago, I was driving by one day and I saw when our first building was there in Conyers, and a guy I went to college with whose church is still there all these years, this is like 30 years later, they're still there. I went to college with him and his wife, and I was like, I can't believe the Assemblies of God they assigned a guy there. I mean, like, it just bothered me. Yeah, why did they tell me he was going into my old building? And, you know, my dad was on the council. Like, I'm sure dad must have approved that. So every time I'd pass him in a restaurant or something, I would speak, but I was definitely cold. So one day he came to my office. We were over there on Klondike Road, and that building's not even there now. And he made an appointment. He came in with bread. His wife had baked bread. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, clearly you're mad at me about something, and I don't know what it is. I said, well, I'll tell you what it is. I said, I just feel like because we went to school together, since you were taking over an area that I was responsible for, and they put you in my old building, I just would have liked to have heard it from you. I said, like, let's say we were both salesmen, and this was my territory, and now you took it over, just a courtesy call from you to say, I want you, before you ride by, and see on your sign that you put up there, I'm going to put my name on. Like, I just, and he said, you know what? Touche. I understand your point, and I probably would have been upset if it's the other way around. He said, but can I just tell you, none of us in the Assemblies of God ever think that you even think about us. He said, we kicked you out, and you go and build this church that's bigger than any church of anybody that we know. So he said, I got to tell you, I'm flattered that I'm on your radar screen enough for you to be upset with me. He said, we just thought we kicked you out of the Assemblies. And he's like, well, didn't seem to do any problem to him. He just went to the next level. And I thought, wow, I'm so surprised that that's what you think. I don't think she'll mind this, but I had a conversation with Chandra after the dedication of the Tyler Perry Studios. And she was telling me about some of the people that were there. She said, you know, I'm saying that, like, you know, standing there talking to Sam Jackson and all these people. And I said, well, Sandra, you're one of them. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I'm sure there were people there that were excited to see you because you're not thinking of yourself maybe in that category, but you are a celebrity. I mean, I could say star of stage and screen. That's not a stretch. You have done that. Which, not that she doesn't know that. She said, it's just sometimes you're in a context where you don't think, well, maybe I'm not like them. Yeah, you are. Everybody's just everybody. The people who put on the pretense and act like they're better than you, it's because they feel insecure. The people who really know who they are make you feel good about yourself. Like the celebrities that I have met over the years, the bigger they are, the nicer they are. Like the ones who really already know they're a legend, they'll talk to you, they're, you know, whatever. It's those that are still not sure who they are, they're the, or they think that you pose a threat to them. Bishop, how'd you get all this out of the word they? Because that's how I roll. So I love this kid because in the next verse it says, the little boy walks in and addresses the baby. Little baby, parumpa-pum-pum, I am a poor boy too. Parumpa-pum. Now that's very interesting because he automatically identifies with Jesus. He walks to that context and he's like, I got more in common with this kid than you guys do. Because, I mean, look at this. They're in a barn. I mean, the word manger just means a eating trough. Like if, like in Italian, mangia, that means to eat. So, I mean, it doesn't, I don't care how poor you were. And some of y'all might have been, y'all might not have just been poor, you might have been Poe. Because Poe is worse than poor. That's a whole other level. I doubt there's any of you in here, or any of you listening on YouTube or on the podcast, that were born in a barn and laid in a feeding trough. You at least were at your big mama's house or something. You at least had a roof over your head. I mean, this is pretty extreme. And this kid walks in and he says, I'm a poor boy too. And then this is where it gets, this is the emotional part for me. Because now this goes beyond class consciousness. This goes to who you are as a person, your gift, your calling. He says, I have no gift to bring, parumpa-pum-pum, that's fit to give our king, parumpa-pum-pum. And then he says this statement is a very dangerous statement. You have to gather up all of your vulnerability and everything to ask this question. He says, shall I play for you? Parumpa-pum-pum. What's in that line? What he's saying is, look, I see these people. I'm not like you. This is all I have. You know, Jesus told the story about the woman with what they call the widow's mite. Remember? He said that woman gave more than the other people who made a big deal over their big giving. And the disciples said, why? He said, because she gave all that she had. I've told you this story before, but it'll make my point. Years ago, for about 20 years, I used to go up to Cleveland, Tennessee and teach at the New Life Bible College. And I went fairly regularly. And one night I was up there and I'd spoken, I taught in the school and then I spoke at the chapel on that Friday night and I was driving back to Atlanta that night. And that's back when we used to sell tapes and CDs. So I was back at the table and I'm selling stuff. And there's a little guy standing there. I could tell he was going, had some issues. He didn't look really clean. He didn't smell really good. The kind of person that it would be easy for them to put him on the back row or whatever. And he just kind of stood there at the table for a long time. And I said, can I help you? Because a lot of times when people would come to me and they couldn't afford something, there's no way to tell you how much product I've given away over the years. And if there's such a thing as sowing a seed, when my wave comes in, if there is such a thing as a hundredfold return, I'm flying this all to Las Vegas. Because I've given a lot of stuff away. You know, if somebody just really wanted it and they couldn't afford it. Now, sometimes people were playing me, you know, like, I wish I could afford it. I'm like, well, I just got to believe God, you know. Because you know how that is. People are like, I'd like to get that CD, but I can't afford it. Well, maybe next year. Keep hope alive. Because, you're still paying for your stuff. You're like, baby, I'm trying to pay for this stuff. And I remember he said, are you driving back to Atlanta tonight? And I said, yes. And he said, do you ever stop for coffee when you're driving? And I said, yeah. I mean, So he pulls out this nasty looking crumpled up dollar bill. And I could tell he was embarrassed to even say it, but he said, I want to do something for you. He said, I loved your message tonight. He said, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And of course, whew. And you could tell with the line of people who are, you know, there's people popping down $100 bills, you know, buying tapes, you know, whatever. And I said, yeah, I will. And I made it a point. I mean, I thanked him for it, and I said, I speak a hundredfold return over it. And on the way, that night, I stopped at a Waffle House and intentionally used that dollar bill because I told him I would do it. And there was just something about that moment, you know, because we've all been in places. I mean, I've never really gone hungry, but there have been times in my life where I know what it was like to say, man, I'd like to buy something so that I just don't have it. I mean, I think we can all relate to that. Things that you want to do, and it's like, I just, you know, you try to say it as positively as you can, but it's like, I can't do anything. I think we all can relate to what that feels like. And I wanted to make it a point to say to that guy, thank you very much. Yes, for me to say, no, buddy, you need this dollar more than I do, that would be insulting. I needed to let him. I said, yes, I will. Give me that dollar. Coffee's on you tonight. And I made it a point to make sure he knew that I'm not better than you. I remember when the first time I ever did a prison ministry, was my dad pastored a church in Macon, Georgia. And there was this sort of anti-MAME kind of bigger-than-life character, Agnes Claire Arnold. I always remember her. But she was involved with the prison system in Macon, and so she would get my dad into preach places. And on a couple of occasions, he took me with him. And I remember standing, they stood me on a piano bench, and I sang Jesus Love Me. I was in first grade. And those, you know, prisoners would be crying and stuff because probably a lot of them had kids my age or whatever, and they weren't allowed to touch me. I couldn't, you know, you're not allowed to make physical contact. But I remember even then knowing I'm not better than these guys. And I always kept that in my head. Like when I do prison ministry over the years, I think, you know, if I'd had the same life circumstances that they've had, minus the advantages that I've had, I probably easily could have ended up the exact same place. So the idea of you're too good to do something or help somebody out, there's nothing worse than that. There's a reason why the scripture says the Lord hates a proud look. And from this song, I don't get that the Magi were rubbing it in the kid's face. I think they're just oblivious. They're just saying, we got money. You obviously got money. We're gonna give our finest gifts to the king. Come on, give yours. And the kid's like, I don't have any gold. No frankincense. I can't even get any myrrh. You can't get myrrh. It's pretty bad. But he goes to this king that's obviously a big deal, or all these other people wouldn't be in here coming from Persia to bring these gifts. So this must be something. And the kid says, shall I play for you? Now, that's the kind of question, you know, when you think, all I got is this little talent, this little thing that I can do. That's all he had, was his ability to play a little drum solo. And it would be so easy in that context to say, no, thank you. We're only doing gold, frankincense, and myrrh this year. We don't have time for your sad little homeless boy drum solo. So you just take that noise outside and come back when you got something to give. But I love this line, and I can say it now without being emotional, but there was a time when I would talk about this, I couldn't get through it because I would think, you know, sometimes all you can do is your best, and sometimes your best isn't enough. Shall I play for you, pum-pum-pum-pum, on my drum? And then this is a beautiful sentiment. Mary nodded. In other words, this is Mary's in charge. This is her scene. So for her to say, yes, this is what I visualize. is that saying, everybody, please, could we all be quiet? This little boy. This little boy is going to play a drum solo for the king. I need you all to be quiet. I need you all to recognize. I mean, you don't tell kings to shut up. You're supposed to be bowing and genuflecting. We're so honored that you would grace us with your presence. Mary's like, shh, it's time for a drum solo. The oxen lamb kept time. And then this little line here, I played my drum for him. In other words, that's all I got. All I got is this drum. I don't have anything to give you. This is me. This is my little talent. This is my little ability. I played my drum for him. And I love this line because you got to see your opportunity and you got to take it. And this kid, this is Mary shushing the crowd saying, this little kid's about to play. I need y'all to be quiet. Let's listen. And he steps up. By God, I played my drum for him. And I had that little moment of audition. I played my best for him. In other words, this is, you know, you got to fight for your chance to be heard, to be seen. And when your chance comes, when you've made the trip here and you're with the Magi and they got all the gifts, and now Mary says, all right, now you're on, kid. It's not time to go. You don't have time to make excuses for it. You don't have time to say, now I don't have gold, frankincense, and myrrh tonight, but y'all just pray for me while I try to play. You don't have time for that. Just shut up and play. If that's what you do, then you stand in that microphone or you do that thing. If that's what you've got, it's not inferior to what anybody else has. You play your best for him. And then here's the payoff. Then he smiled at me. Me and my drum. Me and my little, who knows? A drum is probably something a kid like him makes out of natural elements. Wood that he carved. An animal skin that he tanned or whatever you do to him, cured. It's that drum is not a musical instrument. It's him. It's his essence. This came out of me. This is all I can do. Look, whatever it is that God gave you, don't qualify it. Don't make excuses for it. I hate when somebody invites you to something and they spend the whole time apologizing that it's not enough. It's enough. If you're here, it's enough. It's fine. Like, you're missing the whole point. Most of the stuff that people have apologized to me for over the years was so pointless. The apologies I actually needed from people, they were so self-absorbed, they never even knew it. I'm like, baby, you don't have to apologize to me for your house or whatever. These are people who need to apologize. Not you. You're fine. There's so much to this. It's about self-esteem. It's about believing in yourself. It's about whatever your theology is. This is in the Christian context. So he's saying, for this king, I'm honoring this king. Then he smiled at me. That's all I needed. I don't need a paycheck. I don't need affirmation. I wanted to connect with this baby in this manger. And I did what I do. That's the best I can do. And when you know, if you didn't hear anything else, hear this. Once you know that God has smiled on you, nothing else matters. You don't need the approval. He doesn't need the Magi to say, well, that was a really good drum solo. You don't need that. You already got it. The baby smiled at me. The baby smiled at me. I was, you know, holding my new granddaughter the other day. And you know, when babies are, when they're that young, it takes them a while for their eyes to focus. So sometimes I'll be talking to her and she's like looking around the room and, you know, she's distracted with things. There's a fan up there and she's looking at that. And I'm like, Clementine, Clementine, hey, hey. And I have my crazy stuff that I say to her. You know, your baby talk for babies is like your prayer language. Like you say stuff and you're like, why do I even say that? Like, I know this sounds crazy. You're going to have me locked up when you hear me say that. But in the book of Daniel, where it says they I shouldn't tell you all this. The handwriting on the wall, it's written in Babylonian, and it says, it's Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin is what it says. But it looks like Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And so when I look at it, I'm like, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. Why am I saying this? The handwriting on the wall. It's just the language I have with her. But the other day, I was holding her, and she's looking around, and you know, their heads are like this, whatever. And all of a sudden, she focused on me, and she goes, and it's the first time that she's really seen me and smiled. Now, she's made eye contact with me as soon as the first time I saw her. But it's the first time that it's registered with happiness. And I was like,
girl, that was a sweetie girl.
That was her with Christina. But there was one.
Girl, that's a sweetie girl. She's a sweet girl.
Yeah, that was with Christina. But there was one that I was holding her. It's four shots. And I was holding her. And no, it's not that one. It's, that was the one. Yes. I was holding her. And she had just woken up from a nap. And she's looking around. And I was like, Clementine, Clementine, meanie, meanie, tickle you farson. And obviously she just looks at me and she goes. So I'm like snapping pictures. And it's like, in that moment, I didn't care if anybody else in the world liked me or not. Do you know what I mean? It didn't matter. I could get the meanest hate mail from me. I'd be like, whatever. Whatever. Clementine just smiled at me. I'm good. And that's the way you should feel about whatever it is that you have. Don't ever feel better than anybody else, but don't ever feel less than. Don't ever feel inferior to anybody else. Don't ever apologize, you know, for your gift that it's not enough or whatever. It's awesome. I hate when I hear somebody who I think has an amazing gift, then they put it down. They say, oh, well, it's, you know, I didn't think I did that. No, don't. You're ruining the vibe. I loved what you did. Don't take away from it. I just love that this song ends with that. Then he smiled at me. Pa-rum-pa-pum-pum, me and my drum. I'm good. From here on out, there's the green light. I feel good about me. I feel good about what I do. I feel good about my relationship with God. That's the little drummer boy. Did you get anything out of that? Let's all stand. Now you'll never hear that the same way. And I've talked about it before, but I haven't taken it this deep before, and I really think there's a lot to it. Please play this, and then I'll speak a blessing over you before you go.
Contributing to Metron is quick and easy.
Easy peasy.
You can give anytime using any smartphone. Text the amount you'd like to donate to 404-620-5044. You will then receive a notification that you successfully completed your donation. You may also visit missionthenow.com and click the support tab to give there as well. When you contribute to Metron, you're also donating to the charity or organization of the month. Thank you for your investment into
Metron.
If
you're making a check, make it to JESM, and Danny will receive that. If you have cash, go pay it forward. And I want you to have a beautiful day. Be sure to get signed up for the Christmas party. If you haven't done it yet, it's going to be a really beautiful event. I speak a blessing over you. A great day. Get some rest. Be at peace. Super energized for your week tomorrow. Whatever you've got coming up, you will rise to the occasion. You will be fine. God is smiling at you and your drum. Peace.